Then let's continue on. And last time we quickly talked about the RPC language, that means a specification language to provide information for the interface between the interface between the client and the server, and it's as we intended to do, it's done declaratively, and out of this declarative description of the interface on the client side as well as on the server side, the appropriate stubs are automatically generated using the RPC generator. And with RMI, you do something similar as you do in a procedural environment, as a procedure language environment. The next things we can look at are these phases of RPC-based distributed applications. Certainly, you have design and implementation, you have the binding of components, and then the actual invocation of the server operations by the client. The one point is we have three different options with respect to the component binding, design, and implementation. That's basically straightforward, and you can orient yourself along the lines of the software engineering methods and mechanisms. Component binding, that provides what that defines the information with respect to that client knows about the server, where to find it. And the point is here at the beginning that actually the client and server are started independently. Usually the server is started by the system administrator and then more or less running and waiting for client requests. And the question is now, how does the client learn about the server? And one of the things, as I mentioned already in the RPC language, that it was possible to have something like fixed port and fixed host's IP address in the IP specification. And that would mean that when the client program is generated, or especially the stubs, then actually the binding between server and client already takes place. And it's in that case, certainly the server has to be up and running. There's no dynamic binding to an alternative server. It's more or less it's fixed to a specific server. If you want to change the be it the port or the server IP, and because you want to move the service from one host to another one, then actually you have to regenerate the client program. You have to modify this specification file, then generate the stubs again, and then do the binding of the whole client program again. Therefore, in that sense, you're a lot less flexible. But on the other hand, you avoid any overhead with respect to contacting a directory service. If you want to have a little bit more flexibility, you can have something like a semi-static binding. And here, the binding takes place at the initialization of the client process. That means when the client process is started by the user, then actually the binding takes place. And it belongs something as part of the configuration at the initialization phase. And during the lifespan of the client process, this binding is not changed anymore. And therefore, if you want to change it, it would mean stop the process and then start it again and then get a rebinding, possibly to a different location where the server is later on available. Where do you get the information for binding? You have a number of different options. In that sense, there are entries in a database. Sometimes you can use multicast or broadcast message out to the network, then wait for the server to respond with the IP address as well as the port number. You could contact a name service or something like the directory service to find the actual host IP of the server and the port, or we can use something like a mediation mechanism or a broker mechanism. That's actually something what is done by, for example, CORBA. And here, usually, when you look at CORBA, you have on one hand the client object, then you have here the server object, and then you have here this object request broker, and then all the communication between these two, client and server, is handled via the object request broker. There's no direct interaction between the client and service object. It always occurs via the broker here. That's actually then a broker. And for that, the binding happens actually then here in the broker. And sometimes there's also the term trader used for this type of interaction. And we will later see that with CORBA, that's one of the inherent uses. Semi-static binding, and then you could go even a step further with dynamic binding. And that is done, the binding happens immediately before an RPC request is done. And therefore, in that sense, you might have even dynamic migration of services from one machine to another one. And from the client, it does not really matter. You still get to your appropriate service, even if it migrated in the meantime from one machine to the next machine. And in that sense, that's quite flexible, but it would mean for every request, you might have to contact your directory service or name service to get the current location. Certainly, you can also use then, for example, caches and cache the binding and do the same thing as proxies do. If the binding is not up to date anymore, then basically you have to do a rebinding to go to the appropriate name service and then get the current address. The advantage, as I mentioned, is you can have server migration even during the runtime and lifespan of the client. You can even have an easy client binding to alternative servers. For example, if one server does not respond fast enough, the client basically could contact the directory service and ask, well, is there an alternative server which provides the same service? Or you can even have a dynamic server replacement. And that's not really a problem with respect to the client operation. You don't really have to stop it and restart it again. It can be done on the fly. And also with binding, sometimes you can handle the factory problem. What is actually the factory problem? The point is here that you know information about the service, but the binding might fail. It might fail because the service is not up and running. And therefore, in that sense, what you have here is, you have here a bind request to the service, and that bind request fails. For example, because the server is not up and running. And then we would have something like a request to factory server to start the server. I mean, this factory server is something else as the server. I mean, it here, certainly you contact the factory server, which is basically you also interact with it in a normal, in a RPC type of style. And if you're in a object-oriented world, you basically would use RMI to interact. And that would start the server, and then you try a bind again, and this time you should be successful. And this, because otherwise, if you don't have the interaction with the factory, the point is basically you would get an error message back, and that's it. And because you can't bind, the server is not up and running. And you can handle that as a user. You call and at the computer group and ask what's going on. Can you restart the server for the service operations? I mean, that's the usual thing, is you call by telephone or send an email or something like that. But then it's done outside of the client-server interaction. And with this, with the factory, then you could actually have the possibility of get the server automatically started. And it's... In Corba, there's also the option to actually start the server automatically, and if it's not up and running, there's something like there are these activatable objects, and if this if you have an activatable object, it means the object can be started automatically when it's not up and running. Last thing here, what else do we have here? Mediation and brokering. Certainly here the component, mediation and brokering. Here what you find usually with web services here, as here, web services, that's a typical example that you have the web service publishing its interface to a broker or a directory service. As here, broker, directory service. Service. And I mean, usually it's better actually to use the term directory service separate instead of broker here. Because in Corba, the broker has a slightly different meaning. But in literature, you find also sometimes the term broker. But actually, we can put it in parentheses and say, well, this is a directory service. And this manages the interfaces, and then you have an import on from that side from the client, and then you have a direct interaction. The point is here, as I mentioned before, web services are an example that you have a direct interaction with between client and service. Therefore, publishing and then importing and then direct interaction, that's a typical example of handling client requests and with a direct communication. The indirect communication, that's exactly what CORBA is, as I mentioned before, client, service, and then you have here this ORB in between, which basically propagates everything. This ORB can be also, you can have multiple ones, several ones. And it could also look like this here. C, then S, then you have an ORB here, a next one here, and even a next one here. Or you can have it also structured hierarchically. Therefore, you have an interaction between multiple brokers here or ORBs until the request ends up at the server object, and then the result either goes the same way back, or you have a direct interaction with an with the appropriate ORB. And therefore, in that sense, it's this ORB here. It's a virtual layer, but this can consist of multiple physical ORBs in between. It's the same thing as like routing a message using a router from the sender to the receiver. Here, it's pretty much the same. It's pretty much the same analogy. As in routing of messages. Here you can do routing of object requests. And the last thing is important when you have this possibility of publishing these interfaces. You don't really have to include location information in the within the client anymore. Therefore, you can have use either yellow pages, so yellow pages, or just a name to ask the directory service where is the service operation located, and then you get that via the import interface. And in that sense, it's important that the client knows the directory service, but it could also using a broadcast to find or a multicast to find out with respect to the directory service. Then it might send a find to the directory service, and then it would get as a result of the find the import interface. And part of the interface is also then the information where the server is to be found, and also port information. And let's look at broker information. What do we have? Okay. The as I mentioned, you can just use a name. You can use server type, service types, yellow pages, behavioral functional attributes. That's things like cost, bandwidth, and so on. You can use that as a description as part of the export interfaces, and then you could have the current server state. Therefore, in that sense, if the client imports an interface, gets this additional attributes, and then it can decide, well, I don't want to take this server, I want to take another server which has possibly lower cost. And the bandwidth would still be sufficient. And therefore, in that sense, the client can make a choice which service it wants to take. Good, that's pretty general. I mean, that's also in the same way valid for object-oriented environments. And instead of using a procedural language, we can use now object-oriented language. And from the principle, it's pretty much the same. And as we can look at it, it's now on the object-oriented side. especially now with RMI, and RMI RMI is a part of the Java environment, and it's the de facto standard in the interaction between Java objects residing on different Java virtual machines. And these different JVMs can be on the same host, physically on the same computer, but they could also reside on different host machines somewhere in the network. And with different JVMs on the same host, you still use usually RMI to interact between the objects residing in different JVMs. There exists information about RPC programming, and for example, in the past you had it on Sun, now it's available on Oracle. There's actually something like an extensive description of RPC, and there's also something like an online tutorial, and I think here the online tutorial, as far as I remember, it's called JGuru, and the problem is only it was available by Sun, but after the takeover from Oracle of Sun, it's always not quite sure what kind of information in the Sun environment is still available and which not, and therefore it changes always very quickly. But that was a pretty good tutorial, actually. We can look at major definitions. On one hand, you have a remote object. That's basically an object whose method or methods can be called by an object residing on another Java virtual machine. And therefore, in that sense, you have possibly a cross machine execution. And the question is, with the remote object references, what you use it for? Also here the remote object references, you can, for example, use it for argument passing. And pass it between objects, or you can also use it as a result. It can be also the result of a method invocation, especially of a remote method invocation. And because the question is always where do you get these remote object references, and either from an argument, certainly you could also have a library where remote object references are in it. But they can also be passed as arguments, or you can get it as a result. The remote interface, here specifies basically all the methods which might be invoked remotely. And that's, we will see nicely here, we have here a remote object, and that's here a JVM, And here we have another object that's residing on a different JVM. And here you have a remote object. And now you have a number of methods. And some methods may be called remotely. And that's basically here this M1 to M3. This remote object might also have these methods M4, M5. And they are not listed here in the remote interface. And these may only be called locally. So here may only be called locally. And in that sense, a remote object does not mean that every method of the remote object might be invoked remotely. It could be that only some of the methods may be invoked remotely. And as you see it here. And the process, what it's called RMI, allows you the object-to-object communication between different Java virtual machines, even if they are on the same host machine. And the method calls, and that's the similar intention as we had it with the remote procedure call, a method call for a local invocation, because we could also have another object here, which invokes, for example, M1. And it's in that sense, it would be a local call of M1. And the method call using the remote access, using the local access, basically looks the same. And therefore, in that sense, local invocation and remote invocation use the same syntax as we already had it before with the remote procedure call. And therefore, in that sense, it's transferred from the procedural language environment to the object-oriented environment. What it supports, certainly, this remote invocation allows you, on one hand, the communication between different objects, but also it allows you, for example, the information exchange. And for example, you could invoke a method here from this object. This method does some computation, and now you would have a second remote object. And as a result of the computation here, you would return here a remote object reference. And then this object here could invoke another remote object here on this JVM. And in that sense, it's not something like you always need directory service or whatever. It's basically you can pass back and forth remote references to objects. What does it look like with respect to the characteristics of RMI? It certainly it provides location and access transparency. As I mentioned, local calls and remote calls look the same. They have the same syntax. But it's important, an object has to be specified as remote. So here, object has to be specified as remote. Therefore, in that sense, if an object is not specified as remote, methods of that object cannot be invoked remotely. It's not something like, well, you decide, you write the client, and then you invoke objects on some other machine and try to get in contact. An object has to be specified as remote object, and during programming. The other thing is how you localize remote objects. The one thing is you can use the naming facility. Also here, naming facility is one possibility, in a sense, going to a naming server, or receiving the reference by another object. Also here, receiving reference as a result from another object. And that's, for example, as I mentioned before, with a remote invocation. You use remote objects, and the point is here also, as you know from object-oriented programming, an object consists of three important parts. One part is certainly the information about its instance variables and the values. Then the associated methods it has, and then the information to which class it belongs. And the object itself has not the methods included. The methods are basically as part of the class description. And that's what what you need for this automatic class loading. And for example, if you transfer objects and so on, in that sense, it's not sufficient to transfer the object and the information to which class it belongs. If the class is locally available, it's no problem, because then you can make the association between object and its class. If the class is not available, then basically you need something like an automatic class loading just to get access to the appropriate methods associated with the object. And in that sense, RMI supports also this automatic class loading. And certainly, as we will later see, it also supports the object serialization, that you can transfer an object from one environment to the next environment. That would be all part of RMI support. And the last important aspect is that the clients interact with remote interfaces and not with classes implementing these interfaces. Therefore, in that sense, it has the reference and the specification of the methods which are listed in the remote interface. It does not really know anything more about these classes. And if we need class loading, then it's handled by RMI. And how does it actually it's now, how does it work from the steps? And it's here. You have the server object. The server object certainly registers its object. Sorry. And information about this object and the interface. Additionally, it generates then this server skeleton. In the past, we had the term stub on the client side and on the server side. Here, on the client side, we call it stub. On the server side, it's called skeleton. And then we have a a client program which makes a lookup of for the server object. It interacts with the RMI registry. Usually this RMI registry runs on the same host as the server host. Also here, usually, server host and registry host are identical, and therefore they are running on the same machine. But you could actually put it in another directory service, and an example for that is JNDI, this Java naming and directory interface. Here, this one returns the as an export or an import interface at the client stub. Therefore, what we have when we register the service object, the what is registered, it's basically information about the server object as well as the client stub. And this client stub is then sent to the client program, and now all interaction takes place via the client stub. And this one is now the proxy. As we hear, that's the proxy for that server object. And it has information about in which how to call it, which IP to use, which port to use, but also the information about how to serialize the method call to basically send here, because here you use the method call, and therefore in that sense the client stub has the same method interface as the server object. And the method interface is sent to the client stub. That basically serializes into a message. And that message, and then certainly you have the RMI system underneath, and that basically then transfer the information to the skeleton. And that here, the skeleton unpacks that message again, and then it actually makes a method call. And therefore, in that sense here, this is just a proxy of it. That's the top I already mentioned. Okay. The thing when we look at the RMI architecture, it's similar as we had it before. The only thing which comes here new is this remote reference layer. But let's look first at these stub and skeleton. And the proxy object, as I mentioned, is representative of the remote object. Also here, representative of remote object. And what it does here, this layer here, the stub and skeleton, it intercepts the method call, and then it redirects it to the remote object here. And also it does object serialization and deserialization, because as part of a method call, certainly you can have as parameters integer or, let's say, basic data type values, but you can also have objects. And these objects can be as arguments, can be used as arguments for a method call. And therefore, in that sense, you have to serialize and deserialize these objects, which are then possibly transferred via the network to the remote object as part of a method call. Therefore, in that sense, the serialization and deserialization is necessary, but it's hidden from the client application. In the same way as we talked with RPC, that we said, well, we have a call by reference, and that reference refers to an address in our address space. That data structure was serialized and flattened, and then on this side it was rebuilt. And here that's something very similar. And the important part of it is here the stub. Also here, stub realizes the remote server or the remote method interface. Also here, remote server method interface. And in that sense, it has exactly the same interface as the remote object. And remote server object, I mean server object. Well, not server, server object. The reference layer, that's something new. And let's look at it, what it provides. In the past, with RPC, the mapping to TCP languages was done by the RPC, by the stub, as well as the RPC runtime environment. Here we have now the remote reference layer, and we have here this application protocol, or this application protocol, JRMP, this Java Remote Method Protocol, and that implements the whole thing via the TCP IP protocol layer. And the important part of it, it's all the invocations, the method invocations. We can have many methods supported by that proxy object. They all basically mapped into something what is called an invoke. And in the invoke, you have a number of parameters. First of all, the object, which is to be referenced remotely. Then also the method, which is supposed to be invoked. Then we have all the parameters, the arguments of the method call. And additionally, we have something like this opnum, that's something like a hash code. And this hash code refers to the method signature. So here, hash code of method signature. And this is used basically to check if that invocation was transmitted correctly. Therefore, in that sense, it on the server object side, it looks at the parameters, the arguments, looks at the method, as well as the object to be invoked, because the association between method and object, and then it generates the hash code, and then it compares it with the hash code sent in the request. And if that matches, then the transmission is supposed to be correct. And here, all the things are here. It also looks like a method call. That's here serialized. I mean here, serialized. And mapped into an appropriate TCP message. And therefore, in that sense, it's just part of the TCP message content. And on the other side, it's deserialized, and mapped into a method call, and then on the upper layer it goes up the skeleton to make the appropriate method call using here this object and using here this method name and then using the parameters. The hash code then disappears. The hash code is only relevant for that layer. The other thing is what we will look at it later, what the reference layer is also used for, and that's something which is new, which is not was not really relevant in procedural languages like C, because if you think of memory management in C, in memory management you have malloc allocation of memory and free the memory, and it's the duty of the programmer to allocate and deallocate memory in the address space. With object-oriented programming, it's you have this garbage collection. Therefore, dynamically, object space or memory space is allocated. And if there are no references to the object anymore, then the memory is basically deallocated automatically. The garbage collector collects it. And the situation, what it uses references. References to these objects. But if you think now of the situation, you have this remote object, and you might have here references, local references by other objects, it's fine. The remote object is not really collected. But if these ones go away, but you might have here now from this one a reference, then you don't really want that the garbage collector, which basically runs here locally, collects this object because it doesn't have a reference anymore. And all these remote references are somewhat also managed in this remote reference layer. Therefore, the garbage collector looks at local references as well as references which are maintained here in the remote reference layer. And in the remote reference layer, you would have information here with respect to that reference here. In that sense, it has an additional important task which was not really necessary in the procedural environment. The next thing we can look at it is locating remote objects. And one of the things is you have these specialized registry, and that you get automatically with RMI as part of it. This RMI registry, and I mentioned the RMI registry is usually on the same host as the server objects, and they are also started automatically that they are available. And additionally, we have this JNDI instead of the RMI registry, which is basically the Java naming and directory interface. So here, the Java naming and directory interface. The RMI registry is directly bound to RMI. Therefore, in that sense, it's used for RMI or remote objects as part of RMI. JNDI, that's a general purpose naming and directory service. And therefore, in that sense, you could also use it in the same way as, for example, you use LDAP or things like that, just to store names and associate addresses and things like that with it. The additionally, you have this naming class. I mean, this is a naming class, and that's used by the client to. That should be called. I don't know if that's a printing problem or it should be called lookup, nicht lockup. And I don't know if, but it seems like the it looks so similar to an O that when I checked for spelling errors, that it's not really obvious. But now I see it here. It's this naming class has the same signature as a registry interface. So here, same signature as registry interface. And on the registry side, there can be JNDI behind it, or there could be also the RMI registry behind it. But usually, you access the whole thing via the naming facility or the naming class. And what does it provide you? The mapping of names to remote objects. It's the RMI registry. It's a standalone Java application, which is started with the RMI runtime environment. It, as I mentioned, it runs on the same machines as the host, as hosting the remote objects, and it uses the standard port 1099, and the RMI registry is itself a remote object. Therefore, in that sense, you can access it. You can use RMI to access the remote registry. And on the other hand, certainly you have to know how to access it. But in that sense, it has a standard port. And if you want to access a remote object, you contact with the host IP, the remote server, provide the port, and then you interact with the registry, and from the registry you get the client stop for the remote objects you want to use for a remote method invocation. And if we look at the as the thing works here, for example, if you think of it, you have the RMI registry here. You have here the client, and then we have a remote object. Let's call it RO. The first, the client interacts with the RMI registry. What uses it? It uses a URI, and it with a name of object, and uses, for example, the lookup. What it gets? It gets the stop of RO, and then here it invokes here a method called via stop. So here a method called via stop. This is not necessary if the client already has a stop. But it could be that a client only knows the name of the object. And then it's necessary. And the access of is with a Java naming class, and if we look at it, what kind of functions it provides, the naming interface, it certainly it provides a bind that the server object provides a name and then the remote object. You get an error if the name is already bound to an object. And how do you specify the name? It's here RM, like an URI, RMI, the host, service port, and server name. And certainly, it's if it's the RMI registry on the same machine, then certainly then these types of things are known in advance. But we could also register it at some other JNDI registry which is not residing on the same environment. You can have a rebind. In a sense, then if the name is already bound, then it's rebound to the new object. You can have a remote lookup. And you have here basically the string name, and as a result, you get a reference that means a stop to the remote object if the object is already registered. You can use an unbind, and then you can get a list of all registered names, and what you provide, what you provide then here is, if we look at the name, you would basically just provide here the front part, and that's more or less the service name. You would not provide it's something like give like a star that give me all which are basically registered, and you get then just a list of names which are then registered, and that's the interface of the naming. And if we look at the register lookup, how that is basically done step by step. You open up the name of the service. That's basically you want to look up a particular URI. I mean, it's not a URL in the sense of HTTP. It's an URI, and you want to look up here this information and get. The stop for this object. First, you build up a socket connection to the host and a specified port. That means the 1099. Then, what you get back is a stop for the remote registry. I mean, here you contact the RMI registry. You get here the stop back. Because that stop you need to use lookup, because you didn't have that before. Then you get the stop for the remote registry. Then you invoke the registry lookup with here this service name, and then you get as a result back the stop for the remote object. And now you interact with a remote object using this stub. Therefore, in that sense, you basically get two stubs. This stub, which is a proxy for the registry. So here, proxy for registry. And this stub is here, proxy for remote object. And in that sense, if you look at it, Yeah, it's a pretty, overhead what you have to perform with respect to the interaction of the registry with respect to the service object. And therefore, a lot of effort went into it to basically put a lot of efficiency aspects in it to streamline the interaction and to make it faster. And in that sense, certainly if you already have a stop for the remote registry locally, then possibly you don't know that, then you don't really need to get it here again. You can use that stop where you once set up a socket connection and you didn't close it, because the problem is if you close it, the stop is an object, and it could be that the garbage collector collected that stop if you don't have any link to it anymore. And therefore, in that sense, if you use it once more, you possibly need another copy of the stop. The if you look at developing an RPC application, if we just think of the traditional, let's call it RPC traditional, you started out with the IDL and the interface description. You generate stops for the client and for the server. You implement, so here, implement client and server. And then you link components. That was the steps you basically did when you developed a traditional RPC based application. If you look at the things, what you do here is, first of all, you define the remote interface, which methods are available remotely or not. Then you implement the remote interface. Here, the implementation happened here. And here you already implement the remote interface, and then you use the implementation of your remote interface to generate the stops and the skeletons. Therefore, you derive actually the stops and the skeletons out of the implementation. Here, you generated it out of the IDL. Therefore, in that sense, the steps are somewhat reversed. And then you do a remote object registration and then a client implementation. It could be that the client implementation happens somewhere in parallel, as long as you don't invoke the client application. And invoking the remote method, it's not a problem to do the client implementation somewhere here between 2, 3, and 4. We can look at the different steps. Here, an example of a remote interface looks the following. Here, public interface, hello interface, extends Java RMI remote. That's basically a marker that it's a remote interface. And as a method of your remote interface is say hello. This Java RMI remote has no methods. Also mir has no methods which have to be implemented when you use it. It's basically just a marker that the interface here is remote. And this is the method which may be invoked remotely. The remote interface is supposed to be or must be declared public, and that's necessary because if the client tries to load the remote object, then you might get an error, except if you load from a package or from a server where the client has access to it. Otherwise, you have this problem that you have these security problems. And in that sense, if you declare it as public, then it's not a problem. And I mean, otherwise, if the interface belongs to the same package, then loading the remote object, it's not a problem. But if it does not belong to the same package, then you might get an error message. The other thing is, it extends the remote interface, as I mentioned here. It must throw the remote exception when there is a problem with the interaction of it. And if the remote method here uses parameters like remote objects, then you use actually interfaces and not the implementation classes. I mean, if you have parameters either as a return type or as an argument for the method, then you use interfaces instead of implementations. And the point is here that it would return, I mean, as a parameter, return a stop rather than a reference to a remote object. And in that sense, that's the reason why you use, if you have a result as an object, you have to use the interface. Because with the interface, you basically specify that you want to return the stop. And if you would use just a pointer, an address pointer, then you basically would just return a reference to the remote object. But what do you do with it? You can't really use it because the receiver of that result might reside on a different JVM. And therefore, the pointer is worthless for that remote environment, because pointers are relevant only in the same address environment. The next thing is what we have here is the implementing the remote interface. And when we look at it, we can have these two types. First, certainly it has to extend the remote server, the implementation of the remote interface. And we have two options to use to use either unicast remote objects or activatable. If you use unicast remote object, and if we get a method call, and the object is not alive, the server process, then basically you get an error message. On the other hand, if the object is not, or the server process is not started, then it would be activated. Therefore, in that sense, you have the possibility that if, for example, the object was running and then it terminated itself, with the next call you can activate it again. With this one, not, you get an error message. And it looks now, here you have the Hello Server that extends in our case, unicast remote object, and that implements our Hello interface. And now we have here the constructor and then the interface, basically the method we want to implement, like here, Hello World, the current time is, and then just at the current time, which is locally available. The class here can also implement other methods, not just here from the remote available ones. Then we generate the stubs. We have something like this RMIC that you take the server object, then you define the interface, take the server implementation, and then you generate the bytecode for the client stub and the skeleton. And that was used up to Java version 5. If you have a later version, Java version 5 or later, then basically stubs, as you hear, stubs and skeletons are generated dynamically at runtime. As you hear, dynamically at runtime. And you don't really have to generate it in advance. And therefore, in that sense, you're pretty flexible. And also in the development of the client application. Because the client stub is basically generated at runtime. And you don't have to do that in advance anymore. The next and the last step is the registration. The one before last stubs you have here, for example, the remote object, and what is registered is basically the stub and the objects. What is passed between remote objects are stubs. So here, we can say stubs are passed between objects rather than references. That means instead of pointers, we pass stubs between objects, and especially remote objects. And if the register is started on the same host, then certainly you started with a specific security policy, who can access it. And if you look at it, for example, we have here the registration. Here is main, the new Hello server. Then you make a name rebind, Hello server with the object. And then basically the object is registered with the RMI registry. So here, register with RMI registry. And the registry is basically on the same host as the remote object. And what else do we have? No, that's it. The last step, that's the client interaction or the client implementation. And you have here the implementation, as I mentioned, can be done in parallel. And important is here that the client always interacts with the remote interface and never with the object implementation of it. And if we look at the client, then certainly we have here the security manager to set it to the RMI security manager, which basically, if you have no security manager associated with it, then basically you can load only from a local class and not from a remote from the remote server. And especially you need that, for example, if you get an object and the methods are with the class and you need the class to for executing the methods of the received object, then you have to have a class loading. And if you don't have a security manager, then you would only be allowed to do a class loading from your local class library. And if it's not there, then you can't execute it. Here, then you make a lookup in the registry. You get here the object. That's basically a stub. And therefore, in that sense, we have here hello interface. And what we get here is the stub and not the reference to the implementation. And then we can invoke it. And the stub has all the methods which are remote invocable. And if we can't really contact it, then basically we would get some kind of exception, like access denied or whatever. I mean, that's done with a security manager or whatever. And that's here basically the steps for the implementation of a distributed application based on RMI. The other things we can look at it, it's parameter passing. And as part method arguments and results, if we look at something like a single JVM, what kind of parameters can we pass? Certainly values. Or we can pass object references. And that's very easy what we know. Now we basically look at JVMs. And if we, as we hear, between JVMs, certainly value a parameter or argument which is a value, that's not a problem. Well, what do we do with object references? And there are basically two options. And that option depends on our access to it. And if we want to have something, we have the two options. Either we want to have a local access or a remote access. If we want to have a remote access, what we transfer here is the stop. That's what we saw before. We always pass back and forth stops. The object resides at the location where it is, and it doesn't move, and we get an object reference. In that sense, we get a stop to the remote object. That's how we handled the invocation now before. And that's exactly here, this option here. RMI transmits the stop of the remote object. Well, now we want to have a local access. That would mean the object has to be transferred from one JVM to the other JVM because we want to have a local access. And that means we need to serialize object and then also transfer object. The object now actually moves from one environment to another one. That means from one JVM to another one. And for that, RMI passes actually the object itself rather than the object reference. The object itself must be implement the interface serializable or externalizable. And then we have two methods associated with these serializable and or externalizable. We have a write object, which serializes the object, and we have an read object, which basically unserializes the object again, because we rebuilt the object in our local environment. And that's actually what RMI supports with arguments, that you have various options depending what you want to do with your object. Do you want to have a local access? Do you want to have a remote access? And that's basically the option of the programmer, how he wants to work with. And that's basically now here the text here what I drew here. The last thing, very quickly, I mentioned it already before, that the remote reference layer has an additional use, that it basically manages remote references to from remote clients, and there exists for remote, also here, for remote object. For remote object B, you have something like B holders, and you would have then the client listed in there. And when the first client access occurs, it creates a reference message to the server, and then the server basically builds up this beholder's data structure. And then it lists all the clients which have access to the remote object. If the, for example, the client has no need for a reference anymore to this object, and it could be that, for example, the client, I mean, here we have here the link, the proxy, it's actually here. We have the proxy here. If the proxy is unreachable, that means it's collected by the local garbage collector, that triggers a sending something like a remove reference B, which is sent to here, and then basically the client is taken out of the B holders list. And if the B holders list is empty and there is no reference to B anymore, then actually B can be automatically collected by the garbage collector. And therefore, in that sense, that's what I mean. If there's no valid client reference anymore, an unreferenced message is sent here to the server here. And it's, again, handled by the remote reference layer. And the last thing is, certainly you have the problem that clients come and go, and in the same way as you have with in C with malloc and free, very often the free and the deallocation of memory is not really done. The same thing is, you can think of it that the remove reference is not really done, and therefore you would have a lot of these lists, and they are only dissolved while, for example, if you have a reboot here or a restart. Therefore, in that sense, we have a time limit to references. And it's something like a least time, for example, 10 minutes. And the connection to the server must be renewed by the client. Therefore, every 10 minutes, it has to send something like a reference message, for example, to the to B. And that's that the client signals, I still use B. And then the entry is updated again, or is sent to B that it was renewed, and therefore it's marked as valid again. And in that sense, you can use your local garbage collector. The only thing is that the garbage collector not only looks at the data structures here, but also it includes also information which is in the remote reference layer with respect to that. And I think that's it. And we can stop here.